From WXXI News in Rochester. This is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson today. And our connection this hour is a challenging one. It's the link between childcare that can often cost as much every year as a struggling single parent brings home in a paycheck. The Center for Governmental Research is out this week with a new study of the need, availability, and trends in subsidies for childcare. We are joined this hour by the study's author, Erica Rosenberg, Project Director at CGR, and by Carolyn Lee Davis, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Welcome to Connections.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're joined by you two. You can join in on the conversation. You can call us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can also tweet us at WXXI News. This is a complicated issue. There's no way around it. Let's start basically with just some of the numbers that are in here. On average, what do you have to spend just to get childcare if you want to be able to go work full time?
Sure. So care is most expensive in childcare centers. So it does depend a little bit on the setting. And what we look at in terms of trying to get a handle on average costs is the market study that the state does every few years. They actually do a big survey of childcare providers and what they're charging, and then they kind of set the reimbursement rate that they'll offer through this subsidy program based on actual costs. So it's a pretty good handle on what's going on out there in the marketplace. So if you've got an infant, and that's, of course, where care is also most expensive, and you have that infant in a center, you're going to be paying some of the highest rates. So in our area, you're looking at about $250 a week for that care, for full-time care, or almost $13,000 a year. If you compare that to the annual earnings before taxes of a minimum wage worker, that's just a few thousand dollars more than that, about $16,000, $17,000. So, the calculation a lot of people would make at that point, I think, would be not to work. And if you've got more than one child, it cannot be done without some kind of help or choosing a less expensive setting for care.
And, of course, that's $13,000 on top of all the other bills that you're dealing with. Right. Rent, keeping
child care is not
the
only expense, right?
Yeah, paying for a bus pass every month, heat in the winter,
food.
Absolutely,
you didn't mention that.
We can't forget about food. That kind of matters too.
Yeah,
Carolyn, what are you seeing out there in the real world? Are these numbers that correspond with what you see in your work?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the cost of high quality care is expensive, and rightly so. You want high educated providers having good resources working with kids in these settings, because really, for many children, early learning happens while they're in childcare, and this is what's getting them ready for school. And so, yes, really, we're looking at $12,000 or $13,000 per child per year to get them this kind of care.
Which brings us to the question of subsidies, which is sort of the heart of this report, which we should mention also the League of Women Voters was involved with you also in preparing it and doing the research on it. So what's out there? If you're struggling along at or near minimum wage, you're bringing home, if you're lucky, $16,000 before taxes, what help, at least in theory, is available to you to be able to help get care for your kids so you can go out and work?
Yep. And thanks for mentioning the League of Women Voters. They were the sponsors of this study. So CGR and the League kind of jointly pick research projects to focus on annually or every few years. And one of the reasons why we decided to look at the subsidy program was looking at some data that showed in most parts of the state, particularly outside of New York City, subsidies have really become less available since about 2007, which, of course, has been a very difficult time for families as the economic recession has hit us. A lot of people have really struggled. So the subsidy program serves families who are, number one, on public assistance. So if their families are receiving welfare and they're engaged in some kind of work activities or work itself, then they're eligible for a child care subsidy. And then it also serves the other kind of big part of the program is families who are income eligible. So these are families that are generally, low income, working sort of those lower paying jobs, and they are eligible for some assistance for paying for child care if they earn 200% of the poverty level or less. So I don't know if Carolyn has any of those figures handy. She's doing some fancy footwork on her phone, so she might be able to help us out there. But in our county, currently, subsidies are not available unless you're a little bit below that level. They've prioritized families who are poorer than that. So their cutoff is at the 165% level of poverty.
And so 200% poverty, if you're a family of three, if you're a single parent with two children, you're looking in the high 30s. That's your income. And so, you know, as we think back to those costs Erica shared before, really, you're not going to be able to cover the costs of care on that income. And so that's where the state sets that eligibility, recognizing if you're a working family and this is your level of income, you're going to need help paying for these expensive costs. And the state really wants to encourage both parents staying in work, but they also really want to encourage school readiness of children. And so that's where the dual purpose of a subsidy comes in.
So these numbers, in Monroe County, 22% of potentially eligible children were served. So one out of five kids who was eligible potentially for the subsidy was able to get the subsidy. Mm-hmm. Four out of five, therefore, were not.
Right.
The parents of four out of five were not. Beyond the obvious one of, okay, there's just not enough money to go around in the pool, what are the other factors that keep parents from getting this help and that mm-hmm. keep kids from getting the help?
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sure a lot of parents probably don't even know about the program. They're not aware that it exists. So I think there's that, you know, lack of awareness problem. And I know Carolyn has cited to me some national research that I think sort of under any conditions, the biggest sort of expected take-up rate we could hope for in terms of people actually knowing about and applying for the program would be about 50%. So I'm not sure that anyone necessarily aspires or thinks it would be financially feasible to serve 100%, although that's a wonderful sort of lofty goal. I think what we're talking about is, are there ways to move the number up from that level of about 22%, which has been falling in the last few years, as there have been some cutbacks made to the program locally, as the cost of care has increased, and as more parents have been choosing centers, all those cost pressures on the program have reduced its availability to parents. And so for large periods of time, the county has actually, they are always accepting applications into this program, but they've had large chunks of time over the last few years when they have had to deny them all due to lack of funding.
Is there a waiting list that people can be on, or you're denied and you try again later?
Yeah, you have to try again later. The county does not maintain a waiting list. They decided that they didn't want to administer the program that way. I guess they found it was a little bit cumbersome and not giving them kind of the payoff that they wanted.
Carolyn, you have more to add to that in terms of why people aren't necessarily getting what's available out there for them?
Yeah, I think part of the challenge, too, you know, we know from the Community Foundation report that came out about a year ago that poverty's on the increase countywide, right? And that was one of the big ahas for me out of this report that Erica led, was that 43% of the children who are eligible for subsidies now in Monroe County are living in the towns and suburbs. So we're really seeing the need for subsidies grow and grow across our community. And again, in particular, we're looking at that in terms of working families, too. So as you see, the number of families who are working and trying to struggle to make ends meet, and more of them are not able to access this help.
We want to hear from you if this is an issue that you've struggled with, if this is something that you could use some help on. Join our conversation, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can also tweet us at WXXI.org. And Beth in Brighton, you're on Connections.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call. This conversation is really timely for me because I've recently been struggling with perhaps what you may feel is a tangential question, but I'm really curious to know if you know anything about why, for example, the dependent care FSA allowances has not been increased in so long as, a working mom with two incomes. That ceiling has been stagnant for far too long. We just got a bump in the healthcare FSA allowance, which, hasn't been much attention for a long time. So I'm just wondering if you know anything about that.
This is the where it's capped at like $5,000 a year. Is that right?
Yeah.
I take advantage of that myself.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I have not looked into that issue. I don't know why that hasn't changed or been indexed to inflation or something like that. And I don't know how long it's been at that particular level. But you're right. That certainly is something that helps some of us to afford childcare. So it is important.
And this is just so we're clear to our listeners. This is the amount you can hold out pre-tax.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And then used to spend on childcare. Yep.
Right. And I think. Beth, the point you make is really good, too, because it shows that government helps a lot of different working families in many different ways pay for childcare. That's one way, and I agree, that's a limit that we should really be looking at. So that's one type of subsidy, essentially, to some working families, and this is another type. That one, of course, is universal. So if you pay the cost and you put that side away, you're eligible for it and you get it. The difference here is you're eligible for this, but 4 out of 5 children are not getting it.
Good point. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question, Beth. We appreciate it. We are talking with Erica Rosenberg from the Center for Governmental Research and Carolyn Lee Davis, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. And we should mention also that there is a forum tonight about this report that has just come out from CGR and the League of Women Voters. Let's talk a little bit if people are interested in hearing more about this. Where can they go tonight to hear about it?
Sure. So the forum is scheduled for tonight at, Carolyn, correct me if I say anything wrong, 7 p.m. at Asbury Methodist Church. Do I have that name correctly? On East mm-hmm. Avenue.
Yep.
And I'll be presenting sort of the high-level findings of the report. Then we have a panel of folks who will react to it, speak to it, answer questions. Some discussion from the audience, I'm sure we'll make some time for that. So the panel includes Carolyn. Is it someone from the League of Women Voters? Is Kathy on there?
So the League of Women Voters is hosting the forum mm-hmm. along with us. And so in addition on the panel to Erica and I, Nancy Kaplan, who is the coordinator for Rochester's Child, a local nonprofit funder who funds initiatives to help improve the quality that's available in our local child care providers. Michelle Terrell, who's the executive director at a high-quality nonprofit center here in the city, Community Child Care Center in Cornhill, and Sarah Davis, who's a parent who has benefited from having a subsidy in the past, and it helped her at a time when she needed it.
Okay, and that again is 7 o'clock tonight over at Asbury First United Methodist Church over on East Avenue. We'll mention that again as we get towards the end of the show. One thing that came up in this study, and a lot of us, I think, still think of this as being an urban problem, a city problem, a Crescent problem, if you will. And yet you're seeing increasing numbers of kids, Carolyn, you mentioned this to me, who are eligible and not necessarily getting the help that they need out in the suburbs. Where is that trend coming from and where's it going?
The numbers, I just want to mention as a little caveat quickly, because I'm the nerdy researcher here. They do get a little more dicey when we break it down to smaller geographies. However, we all know that levels of poverty are increasing, particularly in some of the inner ring suburbs. So we definitely have more families who are eligible for this kind of assistance in Irondequoit, Greece, Gates, maybe even Brighton. So that's definitely increasing. The biggest percentage increases are in some of those towns, as opposed to the city, where there's actually been a little bit of a decline in the number of families who are eligible, I believe. Yep.
And so what's interesting when you read this report that CGR has put out is that when you look across every single town and suburb in Monroe County, we've got families who are eligible, right? So there's no town that doesn't have families who are needing help with this expensive cost. And as Erica is saying, in some communities have seen this grow dramatically just in the last 8 to 10 years. So, for example, Irondequoit has seen a 50% increase. 50% more families are qualifying for this now than they have in the past. Parenton has seen a 42% increase. So in Gates, 72% increase. So this is like vastly increasing in an area where families really need help.
And in terms of actual availability of affordable child care, is that keeping pace both in the city and in the suburbs with the need that's out there for it?
Well, so Monroe County is really lucky to have a high number of high-quality providers, both in Rochester and in the surrounding area. And again, high-quality care can be found both in child care homes and in child care centers. It can be found in all different settings. But it's expensive, as we've said before. So there's, depending on what help you have to pay for, it helps decide whether it's really affordable and accessible.
Okay. Join the conversation with us here on Connections, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Jane in Rochester, you're on Connections.
When children get the vote, maybe things will finally improve. I did read the article this morning in the Democrat Chronicle about the situation, and I don't understand how we can know the problems with poverty and be cutting any programs. It should be such a priority to get down to the nitty-gritty on solving some of these problems. I just don't get it. We're second in the nation in poverty for a town our size. It's, to me, that tells me it's a crisis, and we're not going in the right direction. Can you speculate, any of you, on why, when we get these sort of statistics on poverty, that our officials don't do some adjusting in their own priorities and do some lobbying with the state, if that needs to be, to get more money for these programs? Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Carolyn, you were just in Albany yesterday.
I was just in Albany yesterday. That's true. And so this is, you know, a challenge to pay for these costs. Countrywide, there's challenges to pay for this, and certainly across New York State, there's huge challenges. I think what Jane is referring to is the piece in the paper this morning that shared that our local county is making a choice to reduce the amount of local dollars that are invested in childcare subsidies. The county executive stated last night that she'll be cutting $600,000 of local dollars that get devoted to this, which is about probably between 90 and 100 children would lose their subsidy for next year. And as Jane says, it is hard to fathom that kind of a cut at a time like this. And again, that cut would specifically actually be from the slice. You all were mentioning the different slices. Some are financial assistance, some are working families. This slice is entirely from those families who are working. So those families who you might argue need this help the most to stay employed and keep their children in a safe and quality environment will have this loss. And it is dangerous to speculate. I will say, in terms of the children's agenda, we take a look at the Monroe County budget every year when it comes out and do an analysis of it. It was just released this morning. And so we are taking a very careful look at the numbers. At our first glance, the numbers in the budget document do not completely match up with what was shared last night. So we're looking at all the information and gathering what we can know, and then we'll be putting out our analysis and further information.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, this is where budget priorities become clear. And the county executive has made no secret that her top priority, I think the whole time she's been in office, has been to hold tax rates stable. And there's a lot of folks out there that agree with that. So not to defend anyone's particular point of view, but there's, you know, these are the choices that public officials have to make. The argument that the county executive makes is that there's very little in her budget that she actually can reduce. So she's, you know, perhaps got a limited set of choices there. There are counties, I will say, though, that have prioritized this higher in the mix of what they try to deliver. So Onondaga County is one that we compare, you know, on a lot of factors quite well to in terms of just being similar. So we highlight some information about them in the recent report. And Onondaga has actually increased support for subsidies, and they've increased the number of subsidies available since 2007 by 16%. So it's possible at the local level to prioritize this. If you're trying to hold taxes steady, that makes it particularly difficult.
Can you point to results? Are there concrete results you can look at and say, okay, Onondaga County did this, there are more kids getting subsidies, therefore what?
Great question. And that's one I'll probably ask Carolyn to speak to, because she's sort of the expert in looking at evidence-based research and how that backs different approaches. I mean, one of the things I think that makes talking about child care subsidies a little bit difficult is that parents really do choose the setting. And that's one of the things that advocates like Carolyn have worked on here locally, is to spread the word more about the importance of choosing a quality provider, but it's still up to parents. So subsidies can go to what's called legally exempt child care providers. They're not all bad either, but those are folks that aren't licensed or regulated or anything like that. So it can be family members. So, you know, part of the argument for child care subsidies is that it opens up access to more expensive quality settings. But it's not exactly a one-to-one argument, because it is really up to the parents in terms of where they send their kids.
So I would say Rochester is really lucky to have benefited from about 14 years of research of our UPK classrooms. So this is where the majority of Rochester's four-year-olds spend their time and where they are getting their early education when they're four. And we have incredibly high results from that. We have some of the highest quality child care and early education happening in those that's measured across the country. You see substantial growth for children, over a year's worth of growth that happens in that year. And so that's really hard. We don't have the same kind of evaluation available for just childcare as a whole industry. So we're able to look at some national standards and results and make some estimates. But really, again, there's pockets of quality in every type of, whether you're delivered in a home or delivered in a center. And it's really, but we don't have concrete results on where it is.
Okay. You're listening to Connections. Evan Dawson has the day off. I'm Scott Feibusch here on WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. And you can join us too. Tweet us at WXXI News. Call us at 844-295-8255. Bernard in Fairport. Hi, Bernard.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'm a little concerned about the fact that this seems to be a financial discussion when, in fact, and I agree with Jane, this is a social discussion. I mean, can you imagine a three-year-old not getting enough to eat, not being able to play, not being safe? And how can you think about that happening in the United States of America when we give subsidies to oil companies and there are major corporations that don't pay taxes and other things? So I appreciate the financial discussion, but I think we're missing the point. We are the United States of America. We need to support young children despite whatever is happening. We can't simply not let them eat, not be educated, so on and so forth. And again, to that, you know, to get back to the financial conversation, which, as I say, is a secondary issue, how do we compare to other countries? What happens to a child in Norwegia and so on and so forth? And how can we justify the fact that we have children that aren't being taken care of? It just seems very, very shameful that this is going on in the United States. Thanks very much for the conversation.
Thanks, Bernard. Wants to take that?
Not going to argue that point at all. Obviously, there are social welfare states that do a lot more in terms of spending public dollars to support families, to support quality early care, more generous with child tax credits. Obviously, our country doesn't come down quite that way when it comes to the political and the you know, the philosophy that we take towards supporting families. We do a certain amount of it, and then, you know, we have a lot of people who are concerned about the burden of government costs and taxes. And I certainly appreciate what Bernard had to say in terms of the importance of making sure kids are fed and clothed and cared for. The reason we're talking about it in financial terms, of course, though, is that those things cost money. And if families can't provide them, it's a question of how we fix that problem.
And those numbers are daunting. You've got them right here in the report, that to provide service to everybody who is eligible, 200% or less of the federal poverty level, you're looking at $222 million just in Monroe County alone,
right.
As compared to $42 million and about to be a little bit less that we're spending on that right now.
Right.
Is there any political willpower anywhere that either of you see out there to make that happen right now?
Well, like I say, there are counties that have made different choices. I talked a little bit about Onondaga. New York City is another example. In New York City, they're serving about a quarter of the need, so they're doing a little bit better than Monroe County, and they've been increasing in recent years rather than decreasing. So, you know, when we talk about what it would cost to provide universal care, again, I'm not sure anybody is shooting for that as a realistic goal, not that we wouldn't hope to get there, you know, perhaps in our ideal frame of mind. But I guess the questions I'm trying to raise in the report are there ways to target this aid? You know, one of the things that really strikes me in studying the program over the last several months is the funding is really driven by very old data in some cases. So there's a mandated local share that the county needs to spend on the program. I'm told that is based on caseloads in 1995. And then the way that the state and federal funding is allocated to counties is based on spending in the last 5 years. So as far as I understand it, there's nothing sort of in that decision-making process that does look at need across the state. And I don't know how Monroe would fare if we actually did that. If we went to more of a needs-based formula, we might fare worse, we might fare better. Nobody's that I know has kind of modeled that out. But I'm really struck by a seeming sort of lack of thoughtfulness in how the program is really driving funding currently.
And I would just build on a little bit of what Erica's saying and again say, you know, we would estimate those numbers were a little bit less or actually probably less than half of that. Again, Erica referenced this take-up rate of 50%. The research really indicates even if you had all the money, you would probably have about 50% of families who are eligible who would make use of a subsidy. And that's partly because we have wonderful programs like UPK. The four-year-olds are going there, so that reduces some of your needs. You have parents who work swing shifts or who want grandma or grandpa to take care of their child. So So even though a family might be eligible, they're not always going to need to take advantage of it.
Private charity care out there that can provide for that in some areas.
Yeah, right. Lots of different community resources that come in. So that helps with that. But I would say something that gives us hope. People may have seen that recently the Seattle City Council just voted to increase their taxes and to pay a higher tax to be able to provide universal early education to 3- and 4-year-olds there, which is really exciting and a step in the right direction, I think, as we think about what our community goals are and how we move forward as a community and then how we as a community help make sure that they happen.
All right. We are talking about a new report that is out on subsidies for child care here on Connections from member-supported public radio. We will continue our conversation with Erica Rosenberg, Carolyn Lee Davis, and you right after a quick break.
I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Education Friday, and we look at taking kindergarten back to its roots, away from the recent and modern innovation of making kindergarten academically rigorous, including some kindergartens that even talk about college prep for 5- and 6-year-olds. We're looking at kindergarten, what it was it meant to be, that conversation on Friday on Connections.
Atlantic City needs a turnaround plan, and it's betting on conventions.
This is the business that will evolve and regrow Atlantic City.
The strategy is ambitious and risky.
Doing things like building more retail, building more convention centers has a very limited upside.
Recasting Atlantic City, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
It is Connections from member-supported public radio, WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. Evan Dawson has the day off. I am Scott Feibusch sitting in for him today. And we are talking about a new report on subsidies for child care for needy families. We're talking with Erica Rosenberg from the Center for Governmental Research and Carolyn Lee Davis, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. And I want to ask you, we're addressing all of this, you know, right now from the subsidy piece of this, but of course, one of the big public policy discussions right now is this question of minimum wage versus where the poverty level is. And we're seeing a pretty big push all over the country, both, you know, locally. You mentioned Seattle before, and we've seen communities out in Washington State and California raising local minimum wages. We're seeing a statewide raise here in New York in the minimum wage coming next year. And we've seen these referendum votes in some states where you wouldn't necessarily expect it, places like Nebraska, for instance, voting very strongly, overwhelmingly almost, to increase their minimum wages significantly. What, if anything, is the hope of improving things on that and making people better able simply to pay out of their own wages for what's available out there to take care of the kids?
I think that's a huge part of the answer. I mean, the point is overall what resources families in our community have, and the better able that you are to get a job that pays the wages that you can live on and cover your expenses is the ideal, right? I mean, that's the goal. It's not to have more programs and services. It's to have more families be self-sufficient and be able to pay these costs. So I think economic development and being able to build our supply of jobs and jobs that have a career ladder and a living wage is an incredibly important priority for our community.
Yeah, I just think the minimum wage would have to go up a tremendous amount to really make a difference, right? If we're talking about those figures that we talked about at the top of the hour of, you know, center care costing something like $12,000 or $13,000 for an infant, and minimum wage at this point yielding, you know, $16,000-$17,000 and all the other expenses, I mean, every little bit helps. So it would go somewhere toward helping folks out, but it'd have to go up quite a bit.
Yeah, the difference even from $7.25 to where we're going, $9.50 in New York State is, not gonna cover all of that, obviously.
Right. I think the common issue here with both of these pieces, too, of whether it's childcare, whether it's minimum wage, in both cases, it's looking at making sure that when you do the equation of deciding, am I going to go out into the workforce and work, you want to see that work pays, right? And you want to see whether it's the wage that you're going to earn or whether you have help paying for the additional expenses that you're going to have, that making that working in the community pays.
These are discussions I've had in my own household, you know, with small kids. You know, should you go back to work? Does it make more sense for you to just stay here by the time we pay somebody mm-hmm. for the amount of time you're going to be outside of the house? So these certainly are conversations that happen not only at the very bottom end of the income scale, but all over. Is there hope, perhaps, you know, you look at those costs of $12,000 a year for center care, it goes down a little bit, certainly for kids who are a little older, and then you get into UPK and after school care as they get into school. Are there lower cost options? You had mentioned these uncertified with their family members or friends taking care at home. Or are there other options that are being discussed that are possibilities to provide things at lower care? At lower cost, rather?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting, right. I think, you know, what we always have to look at there is what you're giving up. So some families are really lucky that they have a loving adult who can spend time with their child, and whether it's a grandparent or a neighbor or a close friend, and that child gets a high quality experience. But that's more rare than it is common. And so the challenge is that high quality experiences for young children end up costing a lot. And it's about how we cover those costs versus trying to find less expensive options.
All right. We should mention also once more that there is a forum taking place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Asbury United Methodist Church on East Avenue, where you can hear directly from Erica and Carolyn and several other panelists. They're going to be discussing this report, and there will be a chance for Q&A, too. We'll be taking some questions, too.
Definitely.
Some time to take some of your questions, too, at 844-295-TALK. You can also tweet us at WXXI News. We have, who's next here? Kevin in Brighton. Welcome
Hi.
To Connections.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, I'm calling because I had an experience about 12 years ago dealing with this problem. I got laid off from a job, and I wanted to go out looking for another job, and I was a single parent then. And the problem I ran into was that I either had to be on welfare getting cash assistance, or I had to already have a job. I couldn't be laid off from a job and getting unemployment insurance and get a daycare subsidy. So that made it very, very difficult for me to go look for a job.
Yeah, interesting point. I think, is that a local option, Carolyn? I'm still kind of trying to learn all the ins and outs of the rules and who makes them, whether it's at the state and federal level or the county level. But in terms of
county, it was the county.
It's at the county level. That is a local decision, yes.
So is that still the case that the county does not provide subsidies if parents are looking for work rather than actually have a job?
There is a small grace period that our county will allow you to keep receiving your subsidy, and I believe it's 2 weeks. So if you end a job, I believe you have 2 weeks before your subsidy runs out that you can take advantage of. Counties can choose to make that a longer period. Often we know that in our economy, it does take more than 2 weeks to find a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely in recent years,
and,
right?
And then
for
some.
A lot of people.
Yeah. And then some, 2 weeks.
Yeah, no, that's a challenge.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. We are talking about subsidies for children's health here on, or for child care rather, here on Connections with Erica Rosenberg and Carolyn Lee Davis. How difficult is it, you know, if you are in fact getting these subsidies, how much do they actually cover? What can you expect to get? How much help does it actually provide? And how difficult is it then to fill that gap when you're paying for heat and you're paying for food and you're paying for rent?
Yeah, you bring up a good issue, again, a kind of a local option issue, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is that families that are earning more than the poverty level but still qualifying for subsidies pay a copay toward their care, and the amount of that copay is determined by the county. So I think it can range from something to 35%, maybe 0 to 35%.
15.
15. Mm-hmm. 0 to 15. Say that again.
15 to 35%.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Counties have eliminated the copay, I think, in some instances. In any case, so if a county is collecting a higher copay level, then it can certainly be more difficult for families even to use the subsidies. And at some point, families may decide to give it up, even if they're still eligible for it, depending on what that copay level is. Because what that 35% is it's of your above poverty income. So it can end up being, quite a significant number of dollars. And Monroe is at the 35% level. Some counties are lower. Many counties are at the 35% level. And I did interview officials in some counties that eliminated the copay. One thing we also haven't talked about is that back when there was the federal stimulus package to sort of jumpstart the economy after the recession, some of that actually flowed through states down to the counties to increase the level of child care subsidies. And what some counties chose to do, some of them eliminated the copay, some opened up more slots. The money went away, though, in 18 months or 2 years. And in a lot of places, not in Monroe, that's actually resulted in families being cut off of subsidies. So there's been counties where dozens or hundreds even of families have lost their subsidy with, in some cases, not very much notice. And other places like Onondaga is an example where that copay level has had to increase in order to help the local government to afford the program.
So just be sure I'm clear. Everything that you make then between the poverty level and your actual income, up to 35 cents of every one of those dollars.
That's right.
Can end up being eaten up by a copay. Mm-hmm.
It is, right.
Well.
Yeah, exactly right.
Well, that could be a lot of dollars in some cases, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yep.
It's challenging, to say the least.
Yeah, actually, when you get to the higher end, if you're, and by higher end, I mean like 160% of federal poverty, right? So still making, you know, maybe $21,000, $22,000, your copay can end up being more than your actual subsidy. And so that's why then families may choose to not take advantage of it.
I can understand why. What resources are available if you are a parent in this situation, if maybe you weren't aware that this program even existed? Where do you go to start getting help from it if this is something that you think might benefit you?
So you can go to the county, the Department of Human Services, and pick up an application there to apply. And as Erica said, they're always accepting applications, and then it's just a question of whether they're processing at that time or not. And then you will find out if you are eligible. You can also work. Many child care providers help assist families in the process to apply for a subsidy. Also, the Child Care Council is a wonderful resource for families, both in learning about subsidies and help for paying for care, as well as access where there are care options in their community.
Because that can be challenging, too, just finding someplace that's the right fit. And
exactly right.
That's potentially affordable. Kathy in Penfield, you are next on Connections.
Hi. Hi, Erica and Carolyn. This is Kathy Nixon.
Oh,
and
hi.
I wanted to ask if you, well, first I want to agree with the previous caller. I do believe that this is a moral issue. But I would like to ask you to speak to two issues, if you could. One is community, the payback to the community in dollars for each dollar spent on child care subsidies. And if you don't have that information, at least speak to the impact that the support has to the employers in this community.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Thank you, Kathy, for asking it. And so what we can speak to, where the research is really clear, is that when you invest money in high-quality early education for our most vulnerable children, those children who are living in more vulnerable situations, that the return on investment is between $7 and $14 for every dollar invested. So that's for any family, for example, who uses this subsidy to be able to access a high-quality child care provider, whether that's a center or a home in our community, that you will see a return of $7 to $14 on the $1 that you invest, which is pretty dramatic when you think about the returns that we get in on other investments.
Yeah.
So that's a really, and that comes from 40 years of research of following and really looking at the ways that different dollars are saved. What that adds up to essentially is both children being more ready for school, for example, and needing less in special education services. You have big cost savings there. But what's amazing is what you find is that when vulnerable children have access to high-quality early education when they're young, they actually have much better life outcomes than they might have had otherwise. So, for example, they're actually better, more likely to graduate from college. Graduate from high school. They're more likely to attend college. They're less likely to have a teen pregnancy. They're less likely to ever go on financial assistance or what we think of as welfare. They're more likely to be self-sufficient and employed. And it's kind of amazing to think that what happens in those first 5 years of life can have that kind of impact. But I would just also point to really quickly, you know, we also know from the research that about 85% of brain development happens in those first 5 years. And that's partly why you see that huge kind of impact from this early investment. Unfortunately, about 90% of public dollars that get invested in learning happen after year five. So there's a bit of a mismatch there in terms of when kids really need high quality early learning services, when their brains are getting developed, and when the public investment happens.
Sounds pretty short-sighted of us.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kathy, so much for the call.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow
sure,
up this
yeah.
bill and ask about impact on employers as well.
Good question.
Yeah, I don't have any statistics to discuss, but obviously it's a benefit to employers when they can access a workforce that they might not otherwise be able to access. And if parents have their kids in high-quality settings that they can depend on, it's just peace of mind during the workday. I mean, I know when I first went back to work after having my first child, I had a very kind neighbor who I was actually paying, but it was an informal arrangement. She had her own kids. So I was not out not only when my baby was sick or when I was sick, but when anyone in her house was sick. And there was just a lot more kind of uncertainty and stress around missing work. So that, you know, reliability of the setting can be really important for parents and employers.
Yeah, and I would say Erica's situation, that's really found in the research too. So to your point, there have been studies that have been done that are actually, that survey employers. So this is not just employees saying how they benefit, but really what employers see as benefits and also tracking productivity of their workers. And what you find is that when a parent has access to a steady subsidy for their child, that they're less absent. So they are showing up at work and showing up at work on time more often. They're more productive on the job. So just as Erica said, you're not, half of your brain isn't thinking about, is my child somewhere safe, but you, that you're able to really be concentrating on the work that you're paid to be there doing. And so that you also have less turnover, so that staff come in, they're trained, they're able to stay on the job and stay there better. So there's tremendous benefits to our employers in the community when families can access child care subsidies and know that they're going to have the continuity of them.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks so much, Kathy. Appreciate the call. I want to ask, for the benefit of our listeners in the Finger Lakes and in the Genesee Valley, a lot of this report focuses obviously on the larger urban counties of the state where this need is greatest and where the subsidies are the greatest. What can you tell somebody who might be in Ontario County, in Yates County, in Livingston County? What's available for them subsidy-wise? Are you seeing any kind of trends outside of Monroe County in smaller rural areas?
Yeah, the program is available, generally speaking, on the same basis in every county, although there are, as we've been discussing, a series of decisions that local governments make about how to implement it. So in terms of what the income eligibility level is, that can vary. What the family share copay level is, that can vary. But it certainly is available and something that folks in any of these counties can apply for. We weren't able to sort of do in-depth studies of all of the counties in the state. What we do know is that since 2007, the number of subsidies provided has decreased, and I think it's 38 of the 57 counties outside of New York City. So when we talk about the decline in Monroe, it's certainly not alone. There really has been this decline in the predominant number of counties. And actually, the average decline in those 38 counties where the number of subsidies fell was 27%. So there have been big declines in some of the smaller counties across the state.
I would imagine getting some access issues, too, just with having something nearby if you're in a rural area that you could even take advantage of if you had the money to pay for it, right?
Sure.
Exactly right. And you find that, again, Rochester is lucky to have a lot of high-quality centers and providers and home-based providers in the community, but that a lot of communities don't have the same number of providers, let alone high-quality providers that they're able to access.
A number of our callers have touched on this over the course of our hour together, and I want to sort of close off with this in our last few minutes together. You know, the system that we have clearly comes together as some sort of a patchwork. You've got these subsidies that are helping to pay for things that salaries don't. You have care that's probably more expensive than a lot of people can afford. If you could rip the whole system up, if you could just start from scratch without all of the political legacy that's involved, how would you reconstruct it? What would you make available to parents and kids if you could just start it over from scratch right now?
Carolyn's going to have a bigger, better answer than I will on this. But I would say, at the very least, you know, we need to look at how we're allocating these dollars, these federal and state and local dollars, and try to inject something into that formula that really makes it driven by need. There is need in every county, but right now, sort of basing the funding formulas just on historical levels of spending, to me, doesn't seem to make much sense.
I think what's really important when we think about community-wide, our children and our families, it's thinking about how we're aligning the resources we have and how we're connecting things, both as agencies, as government, as nonprofits, as the community, as well as how we're helping parents connect those pieces. So we have pockets of really high quality home visiting programs like Nurse Family Partnership here, but not to scale and not able for enough families to get it. We've got really high quality care, but because there's not enough enough help paying for it. Not nearly enough families, one out of five only, are able to access it, who are eligible for it. And then it's making the connections between all those worlds too. So I think that we really need to be thinking about how we ramp things up. I think it's also really thinking about putting the child in the center of it, which can be hard, but thinking about what does a child need and how do we make sure that child is ready for school and for life and what an impact these 5 years have, and building our resources and our planning and our services for children and families really around those child needs.
We have time for one more quick call. Keith in Farmington, thanks for joining us.
Interesting show. Got a couple questions. Has anybody ever looked at long-term studies or how it would affect child care if we treated new moms with a little bit more respect, gave them 1 year worth of disability or two parents, you know, something like that, so they can actually stay home and nurture their children like the rest of the industrialized nation? And just a little comment. I was, I had the opportunity to visit two daycare centers within 1 week for business. One was county run, and one was at a large university in the area. And what I found appalling was the different level of care afforded to the children there. It was truly sad. And you can use your imagination.
Indeed. Thanks for the call, Keith.
Carolyn and I are both inhaling. Yeah,
big,
I mean,
big question. About a minute left to answer.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the research on supporting families so that mothers can stay home or fathers can stay home, I mean, I can't cite anything off the top of my head, and maybe Carolyn can, but I mean, I think there's certainly research to support that from a how children fare perspective, that can be really helpful. It can be very expensive, and I'm not sure we have the political constituency for it. And in terms of the variation, in terms of level quality of child care provided, I mean, that's just all over the map. And, you know, as a parent myself, I certainly visited a lot of places, and most of them were no's, very clearly, you know, no's. But Carolyn, what would you like to add?
Well, that last point, I would add to the point that we know that when we look at it, that if you have a higher income, you spend more money on where your child is in their first years of life. So doctors and lawyers are spending a lot of money on where their children go before they go into school. So we can guess from that it's a really worthy investment. The other piece I would just actually touch on quickly, really quickly, is political will. There was just an interfaith weekend that was around child care subsidies. Over 3,000 letters were collected in support of increasing funding for this. There's actually a lot of local political will to really increase services for children.
We will hear more about it tonight at the Asbury Methodist Church on East Avenue at 7 o'clock. Erica Rosenberg, Carolyn Davis, thank you for joining us on Connections. If you have health care through the Affordable Care Act, or if you're eligible to get health care through the Affordable Care Act, there is an important date coming up that you might want to mark on your calendar. Joining us for this segment of Connections is WXXI News reporter Michelle Faust. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. We are, you're involved, of course, in our Understanding the Affordable Care Act project. And one of the things people should understand is this coming Saturday, right?
That's right. Saturday begins open enrollment. Open enrollment runs from November 15th until February 15th. So that's going to be the opportunity to sign up for health care under the Affordable Care Act at the New York State of Health Exchange. You can do that online, but what happens? In the meantime, you probably have questions. And that's what we have this project, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. If you go to our website, WXXI.org, follow the link. There is a link to our project, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. And you can see all of our reporting on that. I put a story up there about the upcoming open enrollment, some of the expectations that they have for that. But then if you have a question, please send us an email. ACAWXXI@WXXI.org. And then when you're on our website, you can take our survey, give us a little bit of information about how the Affordable Care Act is working for you, and ask us a question there. And you can see questions from some other listeners, and it's an opportunity for us to answer those questions for you and in a way that'll help a lot of people.
What are some of the big questions that are popping up right now?
Well, right now I'm working on the answer to the question about, if you're a small business owner, how should you go as far as healthcare? Right now, it's not required for small business owners with 50 or less employees to have health insurance for everyone, but they are making the decision if they want to. Like, do I want to cover my employees, or is it better if I give them a slight raise and then have them go and get insurance through the healthcare exchange on their own? So we've had that question asked of us. We'll be answering that. You can see that on actually next week on Thursday. You can see that on WXXI TV on Need to Know.
What is different if you signed up for this last year? If you're already part of the process, what are you going to see that's different this year?
Well, it looks like the process is going to be pretty similar this year. What's going to be mainly different is for people who speak Spanish, who would rather fill out that form in another language. They have 8 more languages represented in their forms with different information that you can get in different languages now, and they now have the Spanish language website. You can fill out the entire form in Spanish, so if you know someone who would prefer to do that in Spanish, that's one way to do it. But it's pretty much the same. New York did really well. Just under 1 million people who signed up through the New York State of Health Exchange, and you know, they're hoping for a large open enrollment. About 350,000 people is what they're expecting, but we'll see, and I'll be reporting on that as it comes.
Any sense of rates? Do we know yet what to expect to be paying?
Premiums are going to be going up about 4.5%. That's about the same. What they're, you know, basically what we've been reporting for some time now. But, you know, they're saying that the rates are going up, but the rate of increase has gone down. It's not increasing quite as quickly as it used to. There's a lot of controversy over the Affordable Care Act. We're just basically cutting out all of the bits and pieces so you can just get the straight scoop from understanding the Affordable Care Act on our website.
And again, that's WXXINews.org, and you can email questions at?
You can email your questions to acawxxi@wxxi.org. Or go to WXXI.org and click a link to the website, and you can take a survey there.
And next Thursday, Need to Know Rochester on WXXI TV. You'll be doing Healthy Friday next Friday right here.
That's right.
All right. Michelle Faust from WXXI News. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that is Connections for this Thursday, November 13th. Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Thanks for being with me today. Evan will be back on Monday. It's Education Friday tomorrow. Right here on member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5, and 89.5 in the Finger Lakes. Thanks for joining us.